Paul's letter to the Romans. We're still in chapter 8, moving at a snail's pace, but that's a good pace. We only got two verses left in this little section, verses 29 and 30, but as is my practice, I'll go ahead and read the whole little section, which is verses 23 to 30. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been growing together in pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, grown inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoptions as sons, the redemptions of our bodies. For in this hope we are saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know what to pray for as we ought. But the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words. And he who searches hearts knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. And we know that all things work for those, and we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom he predestined, he also called, and those whom he called, he also justified, and those whom he justified, he also glorified. And excuse me, I said 23 through 30, I meant 18 through 30. But anywho, so last week we talked about verse 28, and now we come to verses 29 and 30, which, as I mentioned last week, is called in church history the golden chain of salvation, or in some cases the golden chain, however you want to look at it. And basically it's just the process of how one is saved, if you want to look at it that way. At the very beginning, to break it down, the chain goes like this. Foreknew, predestined, called, justified, glorified, in that order. That's the order that Paul lays it out for us, and you notice the first two are, actually the whole chain is on God's end, but the first two happen prior to a human's life, and the last three happen during a human's life. And the first one is foreknew, okay? In the Greek, another way of looking at this is for loved. So the first thing is God foreknew or foreloved his children. And I'm trying to be very careful with my words because I'm trying not to jump the gun. But, so how does this process work? Well, when does the foreknowing, per se, happen? When did God foreknow that this person will be his child and this one will not?
The day he was born.
You're on the right track, but sooner.
Before
that.
Before.
Mm-hmm. It's Jeremiah chapter 1. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And then in Revelation, I forget the exact quotation, but I know Philip went over it. Those who were chosen before the beginning of time, or something like that, or something. No, that's not right. I'll figure it out. But anyways, the foreknowing or the foreloving takes place before. Well, before Adam and Eve, before time ever started, because keep in mind, time is not something that God is bound by. God is not bound by the limit of time like we are. When we tell a story, we have to have a beginning, middle, end. Beginning, rising action, climax, falling action, end. That's how we're all taught to write little stories or whatnot. How every novel works, how every movie works, all that stuff. There has to be a beginning, there has to be an end. I remember when me and Nicholas, Kyle, and I think Jordan was with us. Yeah, I know she was. We all went to see Avengers Endgame. And we all got sucked into the movie, and then it ended, and then we realized we've been sitting there for 3 hours. Which, for all intents and purposes, is a long movie. I know Mom hates it when Lonesome Dove comes on, because Dad will sit there and watch the whole thing. 12 hours later, we're all like, oh, dear Lord. We've been here a while. But all the same, as long as it is, there's still a beginning, middle, end. There has to be. Because as humans, we're limited by, a beginning and an end. Our mind, technically, you might think you can, but let's think about this for a second. Follow my statement here. We cannot think outside of a time limit. If you try to think without a beginning and an end, then your brain will just go crazy. It can't do it. Because even your thoughts have a beginning and an end. It may not necessarily be a coherent story. There are several comedies that are coming out now. I was coaxed into going to watch one of them. It made no sense whatsoever. No idea what was going on. No plot, no nothing. But it still started, and it still had ending credits. Even my train of thought right now, this little lesson that we're listening to, even though some people may be thinking, okay, when's he going to shut up? Eventually, I will stop talking. Eventually, there will be an end to this. You know, we've been at Romans for... No, that's just... He said it, not me. You know, we're on like lesson 55 or 56, I think, of this series that's taken a whole lot longer than 56 weeks for one reason or another. But eventually, this series will have to come to an end. We will get to chapter 16 and it will stop. But God doesn't have that time limit. He is outside of that. I talked about last week how 8:28 in Romans is often misquoted. Another one that's misquoted is a day is like 1,000 years. That is 100% accurate. But there's the whole second half of the verse that people forget to quote. A day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like a day. You have to read the whole verse. You have to get the whole thing to get what Peter's actually saying in that verse. Peter's not saying that for God, 3,000 years is just 3 days for us. There's not like God is operating on a slower timeline or a faster timeline, however you want to look at it. It's that God doesn't have a timeline. He's not limited. He has a plan, but he's not limited by time at all. I've heard whole theories based on that verse. I remember in high school, someone was saying, you know, a day is like 1,000 years, so God's just waiting for 3,000 years for us, because that's just 3 days for him, and Jesus rose in 3 days, so the end of time will be the year 3,000. Wrong. First off, the fact that you came up with that theory proves it's wrong, because we don't know when it is. There's no way for us to figure it out. Second off, again, the other half of the verse. Peter is not at all saying that God is operating on a different timeline, because God has no timeline. A little fun fact about time. Here's a little theory for you. If you were moving at 90% the speed of light, you would actually age 10 years slower than everybody else. And there's a theory that if you could move faster than the speed of light, you would start going back in time. Now, how true that theory is, I don't know. It's something I heard in high school and I thought it was cool. It stuck with me. But anywho.
What the hell proven is astronauts have spent a long time in space.
Mm-hmm.
They age very slowly.
Yep.
But when they come back to Earth, they age twice as fast.
Yep. Yep, because they're moving significantly faster up there. So there's that for you. But, anyways, back to the point. God has no time limit. He has a plan. That plan's falling perfectly into place because he's in control of it. That plan will eventually have its conclusion. But that's us. We are in that. He is outside of that. He is the author of said plan. And he is the one that is making, he's the one that's watching it unfold the way he wants it to. He is not bound by that plan. He doesn't have an end. So when people say, where did God come from, or whatnot, it's just, as hard as it is for the rational mind to get around, God did not come from anywhere. Because see, here's a question that I'm sure some of you have been asked before. Who created God? If God created us, who created God? Let's follow that question. If we could answer it and say that someone created God, you would have to have a big God that created God, right? But then you would have to have someone who created the big God. So you need a bigger God to create the big God who created God. But then you need a bigger God to create the big God who created God. Then the bigger God and so on, and ad infinitum. You never get to an end. And really, there are people who will actually follow that logic and say that aliens created us. And not just stupid people, but really good scientists who have come up with a lot of good ideas. They just happen to agree with that. But then someone had to create that race, and then the one before that, and so on and so forth. It just goes on to infinity. So the only way to actually put it into to the thought process and actually put your mind at rest, because you could stay up forever thinking about this, is that you already have an infinite God, which is what we have. An infinite God with infinite knowledge, infinite power, omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent, all these omni statements, which just means all-powerful, all-knowing, so on and so forth. And he's the one who created everything, who is not bound by time, not bound by life and death, not bound by nothing, nothing at all. He is perfect. And it is because we have a God like that that we can actually follow this, that Paul's logic here. Whom he foreknew. So now, God started life. Now, when he came up with this plan, back to infinity. Why he did it the way he did it? Ask him when we get there. There's no way we can answer that question here. But he started this plan, and from the very beginning, before he ever created Adam and Eve, he already knew about Charlie, Tammy, Joe, Abby, and myself sitting here tonight. He already knew about the cars going up and down the street. He already knew that Philip would be at a dinner. He already knew all this stuff. And he also knows which ones are going to be with him in paradise and which ones will not. Because, and those are the ones he foreknew or foreloved. Now, Paul puts he also. So, one thing that people like to do with this verse, and I accidentally did at the beginning, so forgive me. Because foreknew comes first, we like to think it is actually the number one. It's number one in a 5-step process. It's actually a 4-step process. So, allow me to amend my previous statement. I said foreknew, predestined, justified, or called, justified, glorified, is actually foreknew and predestined at the same time. Because Paul puts here, he also. Those whom he foreknew, he also predestined. Now, keeping to my promise from last week, I'm only going to tell you one thing about that word. And that this, and just to repeat or recap, that's that there's 4 types of predestination in Christianity. And in case anyone wasn't able to listen to the recording from last week, those four types: active-active, active-passive, passive-active, and passive-passive. Active-active is all the way over here on the right. And that is what, and when you say the word predestination, that's where most people, 90% of them, I'll say, will jump to. That's what they think you're talking about right off the bat. Active-active is also called double predestination. And it's been around since the 800s AD with Gottschalk. What it is, it's saying that God actively and physically works in a human's life, like literally toys with it, if you will, or as a puppet master, however you want to look at it, and physically ensures that the one who is saved is saved. No way that they can't be. Doesn't matter what they do. The deck is so high stacked that God is basically grabbing him by the throat and physically putting him in heaven. On the other side, it is also saying that he is actively working, like he's the one doing it, working in the life of the condemned to ensure that they don't have a prayer. No chance. None whatsoever. They're not getting into heaven. They're going to hell. No way. He is physically grabbing them by the throat and throwing them down into hell, to put it bluntly. Yeah, that's another way of putting it. I'll go and tell you right now, you can argue biblically for all four of these. You just have to be very careful. And you have to study a lot. It took me the better part of 3 years to figure all this out. And to be fair, I'm probably still working on how to explain it all. But that's the active, that's double predestination. Then you have active passive. This is the one that John Calvin and all the Martin Luther and all the reformers talked about. This is the one where that you go to most PCA Presbyterian churches, and that's the one they'll condone. Reformed Baptist or Southern Baptist will back this one up too. Some of them anyway. Paul Washer, if you've heard of him, he backs this one up. R.C. Sproul, who passed away not long ago. What it's saying is that God physically works in the life of the saved, like you are my child, you are coming with me. And so he works in their life and brings them on to heaven. Okay? And then for the condemned, he just doesn't do anything. He doesn't have to do anything. They're already condemned from birth anyway, so he just leaves them alone. He doesn't make them stay in the condemned state, but he doesn't have to do anything. He knows that on their own, they'll never come to him, so he just leaves them alone. They harden themselves, if you will. Then you have passive-passive, and to the best of my knowledge, no one backs this one up. Passive-active. No one backs this one up to the best of my knowledge, which is God, everyone's inherently good, so God just leaves the saved alone, and they just come to him on their own, but he physically makes sure that those whom he doesn't want just stays condemned. To the best of my knowledge, no one backs that one up. If anyone's heard of anyone that does, I don't know if I want to meet them or not, but I don't know of anyone that condones that. And then all the way on the left, you have passive-passive, which God just sits there and does nothing. He just lets it all happen as it happens. There are a lot of people who will back that one up. Free will, if you will. No pun intended. He just sits there and watches everything unfold. Those who come to him. Those who don't, don't. It just, whatever. Whatever happens, happens. He has no control. He created it, and he just said, all right, descend into anarchy. And let's see what happens. There are a lot of people who actually will go with that. Now, I'll go ahead and throw my cards out here. From the very beginning, in chapter 1, verse 1, I have been setting you up for the active-passive version of all that. But I'll get to that because Paul will go into that in detail in chapter 9. But for now, to serve the purpose, the first step of this chain is God foreknew you and predestined you. To be conformed to the image of his son. Now, we all know that, you want to strive to be like Jesus. That's common sense. That's what you're taught in Bible school when you're like 5 years old. Can we do that on our own? No. No way. Under no circumstances can we meet the standard that Jesus set. There's no way we can be conformed to that image. It just can't happen. Because Jesus is perfect. The only reason he died in the first place, he died was because he took on our sin. Excuse me. Because again, the wages of sin is death. So, in theory, you go without sinning, you don't die. So Jesus technically could still be alive right now. Because he was perfect. He had no sin. But he took on our sin. Exactly. Exactly. Well said, Joe. He took on our sin and he died on that cross. And because he did that, now we have a way to be conformed to his image. Because now we have help. We have the Holy Spirit. We have God. We have Jesus. They all come to us and grab us. I've told my story several times. Everyone here has their own story, I'm sure. When God grabbed you and said, "Hey," shaking you by the neck or just maybe gently patting you on the head. He used a sledgehammer on me, and he brings you back. And that begins the process of you being conformed to the image of his son. In order that he might be the first among many brothers, or many brethren for the King James. So Jesus becomes the firstborn of many disciples, of many Christians. Because once Jesus died, his sacrifice not only went into the future to you and I, it went all the way back to Abraham, Moses, Adam, Eve. It went all the way back and brought them into the fold as well, because his grace is good enough to go forward and backward. A lot of people think that the Old Testament, New Testament cutoff right there, Jesus' sacrifice only goes forward because the Old Testament had its own thing, so they did their... No, Jesus' grace goes backward as well as forward, because they needed grace too. That all they had was their animal sacrifices, and that wasn't good enough. So Jesus' sacrifice had to go back and get them too. Now, of course, they were saved. But he brought them in. And he's also bringing us, those who are called according to his purpose, verse 28. So Jesus becomes the firstborn among many brothers and sisters, and he's bringing us all in. Yeah, I got time to keep going. Which then brings us to verse 30. And those whom he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified. Okay. Again, said all I'm going to say about predestination until chapter 9. But those whom he predestined, he also called. Okay? Not necessarily called to be ministers or whatnot. We all know they're called. But called just to be his. It doesn't matter what role that person plays. They could be an elder, a deacon, a preacher, a missionary, a doctor, a nurse, a teacher, soldier, marine, because we're different, sailors, so on and so forth. I mean, it doesn't matter what your role in life is. It doesn't matter if you come up and teach every Sunday, Wednesday, Thursday, whatever. There's plenty of people who sit in the pew, mind their own business, and go out and witness in their own way, who will never set foot in a pulpit, who are just as well off as the preacher, or in some cases, depending on the church, might be better off. It doesn't matter what role. Once God calls you, you're called. Congratulations. Game over. Ask Jonah.
He tried to get out of his
Yeah, the fish didn't let him. Nope. Jeremiah, Isaiah, they all was like, oh no, uh-oh, this is bad. I'm in the presence of God, I'm done for. And God was like, no, I've called you. You're going to go do this.
Isaiah volunteered, and then he had like thousands.
Excuse me. But yeah, God calls all of His children to fill in what role they're filled in to be. But the most important thing, He called them to be His. Period. Now, those whom He called, something has to happen to them first, because they can't come to Him in their current state. Once you're born, again, going back to Psalm 51, verse 1, or not 1, but yeah, Psalm 51, I was conceived in sin, as King David said, and in wickedness, I was born, or something like that. Anyways, we're born evil. Inherently evil. That is our natural state of mind from the very beginning. I don't have many memories. I don't have my oldest memories when I was 4 years old and I was sick with pneumonia. But I have several memories after that of me being absolutely terrible to my little brother. He's my bigger brother now, but I'm still the older one, so ha. I was terrible. I was selfish. I was evil. I could tell you several stories of, but to give you an example, but anyways, I don't need to. Y'all have your own. And we're just born that way. Our brain is inherently me, me, me. Me, myself, and I. And it's because it's our natural instinct. Literally. The first basic instinct is to survive. And to survive, you only need water, sleep, food, and to procreate. That's a word.
You will eat and you will procreate.
Mm-hmm.
If you survive.
Yeah, that's it.
And you don't need any training for that.
Nope, you don't. A lot of people like to talk about the military and whatnot and how honorable they are. Let's just say they break you down to your basic instinct and go from there. And they have to, because that's what you're doing. You are surviving. And to survive, you don't need religion. You really don't. If anything, religion holds you back from surviving, because the Bible tells you to put God before your own life. That's completely backwards in our brains. That is exactly what our brain does not want to do, because suddenly we're putting our survival on the back burner. And now we're talking about being martyrs. That's completely against human logic. I mentioned the Frozen Chosen last week. There are several martyrdom stories. You probably have heard hundreds of them. The brain would tell you if you were in that position, lie. Just say you don't believe in God one time, then you survive and you can make up for it for the next 50 years or however long you live.
But can you?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So
people won't willingly die for a lie.
Mm-mm.
But they will die for the truth.
Yep. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. So God has to do something between the called and us going up to Him, and it's called justification. Now, we've discussed that at length in other places in Romans. Those whom He called, He also justified. He has to justify them. How does He do that? Does anyone remember expiation and Yeah, does anyone remember expiation?
Maybe you say that. Maybe you say that word.
There, it's important words. Remember I mentioned the cross?
Right. As long as it is one.
Exactly. X meaning as far from, from or away from in Greek. So expiation is the horizontal arm of the cross. He cast your sin as far as the east is from the west. He comes in and he sends Jesus to step in for you, take on your sins, die with those sins. So now, when you're going through life and you're living like a human, as we all do to start with, some people are lucky and they only live like humans for 8 years, some live like it for 50 years, however long. Or to go off the parable, some do it in the morning, some make it to the evening. But at some point, God steps in and he changes you. And if you're saved, if you're a Christian, you have a saving point. There is a point that you were saved. And it may not necessarily be when you were dunked. I was dunked when I was 13. Got dunked again when I was 21. But my saving point was in between those two. Now I'm not downplaying that. That's still an important part. Don't get me wrong. But you might get baptized and come out of the water and think, wait a minute, I don't feel any different. Don't panic. Don't worry. The justification part will come, and you'll know when it gets there. Because like I said, for me, it felt like I was getting hit with a sledgehammer. Some people will say, hey, I just got pat on the head, and I just felt calm. I'm like, good for you. That's great. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Mine hurt a lot. It's different for everyone, but you have that point, and you may not remember the exact date. You may not even remember the exact hour. But you can see that point in your life when everything changed. Everything was going this way, then now it changed. And you might even look in the mirror now and say, I am no good. Congratulations. You understand the whole concept if you can say that. Because you're right. No one is any good. Anyone who walks up to you and says, well, I'm a good person, is a liar and automatically not a good person. I'm not afraid to admit I'm a horrible human being. Because I am. And that's just the thing. Yep, I do. I got about 7 billion people on this earth right now. But that's the thing. You go back to Romans chapter 3 and it lays out this whole, remember that whole big long list I laid out for you of all these things that everyone's done. Well, Blake, I've never committed violence or murder or anything like that. Really? Have you been angry at somebody? Congratulations, according to Jesus, that's murder in your heart. Well, I've never cheated on my spouse. That's true. That's probably true. But remember when you were a teenager and you looked at that girl with lust in your eye? Congratulations, adultery. I've never stolen anything, really. What about the pen you accidentally walked out of the superstore with? Still counts. Or to go off the rich young ruler. I've kept all these commandments since I was born, or from my youth. Okay, one thing you lack, sell everything you have and give it to the poor and then come follow me. And if you're guilty of one, you're guilty of them all. But
there's been a discussion on that rich young ruler actually turned out to be later on. Remember the one that ran away in the garden?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have any clothes. They grabbed a hold of him and he ran out of his clothes.
Mm-hmm.
But that was him. He was the one that wrote the Book of Mark.
There's theories. There's a lot of theories behind that.
He might have finished well.
Possible.
He kind of fumbled face to face that first time Jesus hit him with that, but like he kind of covered his head.
Possible. But each day, God works in you, and He changes you a little bit more and a little bit more. You get a little bit better. Until we get to the last word of this verse. Well, my apologies, Philip. It's 7:58, and I got one more word to go. Glorification. We picked on you while you wasn't here, and now I am going over. I'll make this quick. Glorification. That's just the end of the line. You have sanctification. You're going through your process of sanctification. You get better off. You become a better person. Then when your time comes and you go on from this life to the next, whether it be when you're young, old, however you want to look at it, glorification, you finally hit the end of the road. And in a nutshell, glorification is when God looks at you and says, "Well done, my good and faithful servant." And you may even sit there then and be like, "God, I wasn't good and faithful. I was a terrible person." God will look at those on His right hand and says, "You fed me. I was hungry and You fed me. I was thirsty and You gave me drink. I was naked and You clothed me. I was in prison and You came and visited me. Lord, when did we do these things? When You did it to the least of these, my brothers, You did it unto me." You may not even know you were getting better. You might get to your deathbed and be absolutely petrified that you haven't done well enough. And you're right. You haven't done well enough. But because of the Holy Spirit, because of Jesus' grace and His mercy, and because of God, you have. You have finished your race. You have fought your fight. And now God can give you rest. Now, one thing I want to make clear, glorification, that doesn't mean that you get a big halo, big wings, and you've got a big gold outline around you. You can say, "Hey, look at me, I did great." That just means that God has worked in you and He has saved you. And now you can have eternal peace in heaven. Ha, 8:00.
It can be done.
It can be done. Questions, comments, or concerns? Okay. Next week, Lord willing, I will continue with chapter 8. We have, 8 more verses? Something like that? A few more verses in that. We'll finish up chapter 8, and then as promised, I'll go in depth with the predestination thing in chapter 9. But if there's nothing further. "Now to Him who is able to strengthen you according to my gospel and the preaching of Jesus Christ according to the revelation of the mystery that was kept secret for long ages, but has now been disclosed and through the prophetic writings has been made known to all nations, according to the command of the eternal God, to bring about the obedience of faith, and to the only wise God be glory forevermore, through Jesus Christ. Amen."